It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
More than 350 artists are expected to take part in the National Folk Festival. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The festival will take place in Salisbury from September 7th through the 9th. It will feature many musical acts celebrating the nation's traditions. This morning, we'll take a look at some of those artists who will be making an appearance at the festival. With us in studio is Caroline O'Hare. She's a local manager of the festival. And on the phone with us is Blaine Wade. He's a programming manager for the National Council for the Traditional Arts. And welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Don.
So, Caroline, I want to turn to you just briefly. We have a sort of a contest of sorts with the high schools and raising money. Tell us a little bit about that.
We do. At our kickoff in February, Randy Day had this great idea to gather the school spirit of our local high schools and sort of pit each other in a friendly competition against with alumni. So he went up there and said, you know, I want to see who can raise the most. He said, I'm from Bennett. Now I just want to know who's coming in second. And that that started some fires. So we have four reps. We have Dick Morris from Bennett High School, Michelle Wright from Mardella, Stephanie Willie from Parkside, and Mike Dunn will be covering Y High. And they are looking to their fellow classmates and to other alums to come together and help raise money to make this festival an incredible success. We are hoping to have two prizes. It may fall to one, depending on what happens. But the first being the most money raised, and then the second being highest participation. We are excited for this because when people have their school's reputation on the line, they really get into the spirit of it. And again, this is all about community building and bring us together. So it's a fun, friendly competition. It's also incredibly helpful and will help bring over 350 artists to downtown Salisbury. So we're all in. So very excited about it.
So and we'll see who wins.
We'll see who wins. And you can find out more if you go to nationalfolkfestival.com and it's under High School Challenge. So if you look at nationalfolkfestival.com/HSC, you'll find out more information. And you can also reach out to your respective school's team leaders.
So now I want to turn to some of the acts that that have been announced recently. And I want to turn first to Klezmer Music, which is apparently celebrated by Michael Winograd and the Honorable, I believe it's Mitch, from Brooklyn. And he's apparently a premier Klezmer clarinetist. Let's hear a little bit about that, and we'll come back and talk about it. So, Blaine, tell us a little bit about the origin of klezmer music. Most people are not aware of it.
Sure, I'd love to. I think, you know, what's so great about klezmer music comes across really, really wonderfully in that track is it is celebratory, joyous music. It is the social, secular music that is, you know, played and enjoyed throughout the Jewish communities and the Jewish diaspora. And that is so much about coming together for community celebrations and events like that, and it conveys that spirit and that energy. It's music that's roots go way back into the Middle Ages, and it's drawing on influences from cantorial melody, ancient folk tunes, Yiddish poetry, Hebraic ritual, and even Greek and Ottoman influences. And this wonderful stew came together by the late 1800s, and that's when the music really emerged and took hold as the music that you went out and heard at these community celebrations and these secular events. where the community came together. Now, the music came to the United States in the early 1900s with a large wave of Jewish immigration that came here then. And what the attendees to the National Folk Festival are going to get to experience with Michael Winograd and the Honorable Mention, this wonderful group, are some of the performers who are really carrying this tradition forward into the 21st century. There was a great revival of klezmer in the 1970s. And really breathe new life into the music. And so many of these artists, especially Michael Winograd, as well as the folks who will be with him, are central in leading this revival in the subsequent generation on into the 21st century and keeping the tradition strong and passing it along.
And now I want to turn to a much different kind of music, the blues. Let's hear a little bit about that with Phil Wiggins and the Blues House Party. So, Blaine, this has been described as Piedmont blues music. What distinguishes that, and including dance, I guess it is, as well?
Sure. So when we're talking traditional music, there's so much within that sort of body. But within, one of those traditions, such as blues, it encompasses such a wide variety of music, Delta blues, Chicago blues, Texas blues. But one of the most well-known and that's really pertinent to the region here in Maryland where the festival will be is the tradition of Piedmont blues. And when we talk about Piedmont blues, that's the region that stretches all the way from Georgia up to the Chesapeake and into the Tidewater region. And it's really one of the oldest forms of the blues. It draws heavily on the fiddle and banjo string band music that was so prominent in this region going back several centuries. And especially the finger-picking guitar style that was prominent in the region, that's very much reflected in the Piedmont blues tradition. And this was music that was originally heard and enjoyed at community settings, country parties, hoedowns, square dances, where dance was central. Now this is music that's largely heard in concert settings if people aren't seated, maybe they're standing. But dance has kind of become separated from the musical tradition. And what this particular group, Phil Wiggins Blues House Party, is doing is trying to bring the dance back into it and reconnect the music with the dance element. And this is a group that's led by Phil Wiggins, who is a true Maryland treasure and a national treasure as one of the most accomplished and legendary blues harmonica players out there today. And in this group, he's joined by another wonderful artist, Junius Brickhouse, who is a dance virtuoso. Both are celebrated Maryland artists who've received support from the Maryland State Arts Council. And Phil has been recognized most recently in 2017 with a NEA, a National Heritage Award, a National Heritage Award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which is the highest honor that a folk and traditional artist can receive. Phil grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, now lives in Tacoma Park, Maryland. And he's learned from many of the masters, Archie Edwards, John Jackson. And then for years, over three decades, he played with Cephas and Wiggins, or John Cephas in the duo Cephas and Wiggins, which was really one of the premier Piedmont blues ensembles.
And now I want to turn to, it's been described anyways, Inuit throat singing. I'm not sure exactly what it's going to sound like, but let's go ahead and hear a little bit of it, and we're going to get back to you. Ah, So it's been described as a combination of rhythmic melodies and imitation of bird sounds. Tell us a little about the group and this particular form.
Sure, and I'm sure, you know, and now that your listeners have heard that really sort of evocative sample of the tradition, I think it's, you know, this is going to be something that festival audiences is very new to them. It's a rarely heard tradition outside of Inuit communities. I mean, it's been, you know, getting more and more attention, and people have heard it more, but it's still very, very much one of those traditions that we love to bring to the festival, and that it's really been seldom experienced by our audiences, and it's very much in line with what we're trying to do in terms of spreading cultural awareness and cultural appreciation. And we're very excited to bring this tradition to the folks who are going to be coming to Salisbury for the festival. And what Inuit throat singing is, it's a form of entertainment that was emerges out of family settings in Inuit communities in Canada, and when the men would go out and hunt and be away from home, women and children would entertain themselves by playing this game. And as you referenced a second ago, the sounds they're making are imitations of sounds of nature. They can be a bird, a mosquito, or a river, any things from the natural world surrounding them that they're trying to depict through the human voice. And the participants stand very close to each other and combine to form these sounds. And the purpose of the game is whoever laughs first loses, or whoever stops first loses. So it was this very intimate game in family settings to see who could go the longest. It's almost sort of like its own version of the staring game. And this group is led by Kathy Kettler, who comes from Nunavik, which is a region in the far reaches of northern Quebec. And she grew up around family members and friends and elders who practiced this tradition and wanted to carry it on, and practiced on her own as a child, and then eventually started performing with her sister Karen. And that's where the name Nukarik comes from. It's the Inuit word for sisters. In recent years, Karen has been able to perform less and less with Kathy, as work commitments have taken her farther into the northern reaches of Canada. And so Kathy is now performing with another really wonderful throat singer, Kendra Taguna, who Kathy taught about 20 years ago, and they've been performing together for nearly a decade as Nukarik, and really keeping this wonderful tradition together. And I think audiences are just going to be captivated when they see them performing, because they stand very close together, and as they're really deep into each piece, you can't distinguish who's who and which voice belongs to which singer. And it's just that you sort of become fully immersed in it. And so I think this is going to be one of those traditions that really, really grabs people's attention. These are wonderful performers who are cultural ambassadors for Canada. They've gone throughout the world as far away as India to share this tradition with people on behalf of the Canadian government. So we're really excited to bring them to Salisbury.
I want to turn to something that might be a little more traditional, Irish traditional music. Let's hear a little bit about that from Liz Carroll. So, Blaine, tell me a little bit about the music, but also Liz Carroll.
Oh, sure, gladly. Liz is, and that track really wonderfully illustrates. It's no exaggeration to say Liz is one of the best to ever play her instrument, the fiddle, in all of Irish music. She comes from a family, an Irish-American family in Chicago, and both her parents, you know, having immigrated to Chicago from Ireland and being part of that really strong community that so many people associate with Chicago. And really wonderful family scenes and family stories ground her introduction to the tradition. As a young child at the age of 5, she was playing her beloved toy accordion, and her brother Tom stepped on it and broke it. As an aside, Tom still to this day serves as her manager, so he's been instrumental to her career from that very beginning of stepping on this toy accordion. Well, to console her, her father picked her up and had her start playing his accordion. And from there, her interest in playing Irish music really took off. And attending Catholic school on the south side of Chicago, she was presented with an option of either learning piano or fiddle. Now, Liz really wanted to learn piano, but unfortunately, they could not get the piano into the family home. So she had to sort of reluctantly take up the fiddle. But that has worked out wonderfully, as she's become one of the most celebrated players. By the age of 18, she stunned the Irish music world by winning the senior division of the All-Ireland Championships, which is really unheard of at that point for somebody that young and from America to be so honored. All the way up through the 1994, I believe, when she received the National Heritage Fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts, recognizing her as one of the leading players in the tradition. And recently, in 2011, she was further honored, receiving the Gradam Ciol Composer of the Year Award, another award coming from an Irish organization. And she was the first American-born composer to receive that award as well. So not only is she thought of to be at the top of her craft here, but in the back in Ireland as well. She is just thoroughly celebrated and held to the highest esteem as a performer. She'll be joined in Salisbury with a great up-and-coming guitarist and pianist named Jake Sharon. Jake hails from Ontario and is one of the real rising stars of sort of Celtic music broadly. He plays with a great trio out of Prince Edward Island, the East Pointers, and is involved in a number of projects. But he and Liz have been playing together for a handful of years now. It's a wonderful collaboration. They have an album coming out around the time of the festival. So we're really excited to work with Liz and bring such an accomplished performer to Salisbury and to do so with this exciting new project she's working on.
I want to turn now to a different kind of music, maybe one we might be even familiar with. It's sort of a Louisiana French kind of music, Steve Riley and his group. Let's play a little of that, and let's pick it up after that. So tell us a little bit about Steve Riley and his group. And I understand that the Louisiana French music, that it actually got some kind of renaissance in the 1960s and 70s.
Sure, of course. Steve Riley and the Mamou Playboys are as good as it gets when we're talking about the Louisiana French music traditions, and specifically with Steve, Cajun music. He's at the top of his craft as an accordionist and a fiddler. To sort of answer your question about the Renaissance in the 60s and 70s, I'll go back a couple of centuries and work my way forward, if that's all right.
Sure.
The French-speaking community, and specifically the Cajun community in Louisiana, traces its roots and descends from French-speaking Acadians who had come to Nova Scotia and Canada in the 1600s, only to be forcibly removed and uprooted by the British in the 1750s as a result of the French and Indian War. They were forced onto ships, and so they sailed south and eventually made their way to the sort of isolated and protective bayous and prairies there in southwest Louisiana. And their Cajun culture emerged out of these Acadian and French traditions, mixing with Native American, Spanish, German, French Creole, French Creole communities that were there and their traditions, and eventually country and western and blues, and out of that comes the fiddle and accordion-centered music that, that so many people think of when they think of Cajun culture today. Now, even though that culture emerged and intermingled with so many influences there, that doesn't necessarily mean the people who practiced it and spoke the French language that was so central to the way of life in those communities were necessarily welcomed. And so there was a lot of people were looked down upon who were of Cajun heritage and spoke French as a, as their first language in Louisiana. And so as a result of that, over subsequent generations, you know, working your way up through the 20th century, a lot of the language skills were lost and people weren't necessarily encouraged to keep the cultural traditions alive and the cultural identity alive. Well, in the 60s and 70s, as with so much else going on in the country with the folk revival and an appreciation for sort of multiculturalism and people and, you know, roots music and things like that, people of Cajun descent reclaimed their heritage and felt much prouder about articulating it and expressing it in public. There were efforts in public schools to encourage the passing on of French language skills and the traditions associated with the community. And coming out of that great ability to express that in public were a number of musicians who have greatly revitalized the traditions, such as Steve Riley, really at the forefront of that. And Steve learned at the feet of Dewey Balfa, who was one of the one of the Cajun musicians who was integral to all the activity in the 60s and 70s and a growing appreciation for Cajun culture. He performed at the Newport Folk Festival to great acclaim and one of the great moments for Cajun music. And he was just a wonderful fiddler and band leader. And that, too, passed the tradition on to Steve. Steve was learning from him as a 15-year-old and carries the legacy of Dewey and all the musicians that came before him and what he does with his band. But what's so great about what they do is they don't play the music as sort of a frozen artifact or a piece from a museum. They keep forward they keep going with the spirit of the tradition, innovating within the tradition, playing with great creativity and drive. This is going to be a really lively and energetic band that's going to be performing in the dance pavilion at the festival. We'll probably have Cajun dance lessons one evening so people have a sense of how to dance to the music and make it as participatory as involved, and follow that up with some great rock and Cajun music from Steve Riley and the Mamou Playboys.
As we finally turn to West African High Life Band, a particular fusion, I guess, of indigenous dance rhythms and melodies from Western sounds. Let's hear a little bit about that. So, Blaine, tell us a little bit about the origin of this particular music. What part of the continent does it come from? How did it grow?
Sure. So high life music first came out of, originated in Ghana in the late 19th century. And as you mentioned before we heard that wonderful, wonderful track from West African High Life Band, it's a musical form that drew on a number of indigenous sounds and dance rhythms and then merged these with Western sounds and in particular instrumentation. So what you get with a high life band are multiple guitars, horns, vocals, and keys, sort of a lineup and an instrumentation that you associate with a Western band, but playing through those, through that lineup, through that instrumentation, a number of sounds and indigenous rhythms that come out of different West African regions, you know. And so after the music came out of Ghana in the late 19th century, it really took off, spreading to Sierra Leone and Nigeria, throughout the early part of the 20th century, and it was a flourishing tradition throughout West Africa by the mid-20th century. And more than anything, this is feel-good music. This is happy music. It's music that lifts the spirit and just plays, you know, all night long if you were to experience it in a West African setting. And this is going to be a group that is extremely popular both in the dance pavilion and anywhere they are at the festival. And the group's band leader and the gentleman out front is the great Babakin Okulolo, who is himself sort of a feel-good, lift-your-spirits kind of person. He's just a great, warm spirit, and this comes across from their performances on stage. He hails originally from Nigeria and is one of the great bassists in the history of high life music coming out of Nigeria. He learned a number of traditional music and dance forms in his family coming out of the Urhobo ethnic group in Nigeria, but also took an early interest in high life, apprenticed under his uncle, who was a guitarist, and began playing bass with a regional high life band before deciding, you know, if he really wanted to pursue this music, he needed to go to the capital of Lagos. And from there, his career just took off. He became a mainstay on the Nigerian music scene, was awarded top bassist 5 times, and he's eventually performing with and touring the world with such West African stars as King Sunny Ade and Fela Kuti. So his connections to master artists are really unrivaled. And then by about the mid-1980s, he decides to settle in the San Francisco Bay Area, creates a number of really great West African supergroups, the best of which is the West African High Life Band, who carries on this great West African sound. He's joined by other distinguished veterans of high life music. And in addition to what he does with the band, Babakin is really known in the Bay Area for his educational outreach work. He does lectures, conducts demonstrations and workshops on African percussion, and it's about building cultural appreciation as much as teaching musical skills. And he does this in schools, museums, and universities, just sharing his knowledge with anybody, and that warm spirit just comes across in all these settings. He's going to be a real audience favorite at the festival.
And just briefly, I want to turn to dance. We have two of them, Jason Samuels Smith of New York, bringing tap dance, and also there's another group described as a famous scissor dance. Tell us just briefly about those two acts.
Sure, gladly. And since, you know, as you referenced, these are both dance groups that we don't have audio to play, but I would encourage all of your listeners to go to the website at www.nationalfolkfestival.com, and there they can read full bios of all the artists we've announced so far, watch video clips, and listen to the audio clips we've been playing as well. But so that's a great resource to go and check out both Jason Samuel Smith and the Chacas of Peru. I'll start with Jason. Jason is really one of the great tap dancers of the current day. He comes out of the Hell's Kitchen neighborhood in Midtown Manhattan. He grew up surrounded by dance. Both of his parents were very active in the jazz and tap communities there in New York City. In fact, his dad founded JoJo's Dance Factory, which went on to become the Broadway Dance Center, and both of his parents taught at JoJo's Dance Factory. So Jason grew up immersed in this world, going into dance classes as young as at the age of 2 and just picking up everything in the way kids absorb. And from there, he was performing on Sesame Street by the age of 9, and then in his mid-teens met up with his mentor, the great Savion Glover, and performed with him in the Tony Award-winning musical Bring In the Noise, Bring In the Funk. And then the other group you mentioned, the Chacas of Peru, sort of comes from a completely different cultural tradition. And this is, again, going to be, I think, one of those traditions that wows festival audiences and really introduces them to something they've never experienced before. This tradition, Danza de las Tijeras, which translates as the scissors dance, is named for a pair of polished iron rods that the dancers hold while performing, and they provide a percussive backing to the dance. It's also accompanied by fiddle and harp. This is a tradition from the southern Andes in Peru. It's a ritual dance that is highly acrobatic and goes back, you know, it's ancient, it goes back centuries and centuries and centuries. And it's the dancers come from a hereditary class of performers who were tasked with mediating between the human, natural, and spiritual worlds. in traditional Andean communities. And what they would do is, these are all about competitions. You would have teams that consisted of a dancer, a fiddler, and a harpist, and they would compete against teams from other villages, drawing upon a large repertoire of steps that were in the tradition, but improvising for each competition, and sort of in escalating levels of difficulty in competitions that would last for about 10 hours. And it was all about representing and bringing honor to your village.
We've been speaking with Blaine Wade. He's the program manager of the National Council for the Traditional Arts. Also with us, the local manager for the National Folk Festival, Caroline O'Hare. Appreciate both of you stopping by and chatting with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Don.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. Many war veterans these days are seeking comfort from man's best friend. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. It's been estimated that as many as 20% of Iraq and Afghan veterans come home showing signs of post-traumatic stress disorder or depression. Other studies have put the figure for PTSD at 14%. The impact can rise from 9% shortly after returning from the war zone to 31% a year out from deployment. Wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have been the longest in American history. Inter-U.S. Kennels Incorporated, a nonprofit organization that rescues shelter dogs and trains them to help veterans cope with PTSD, brain damage, and other combat-related injuries. To talk about this approach, we have in our studio this morning Chris Hardy. He's the executive director of the organization. Also, Dan Atkinson. He is a 25-year veteran of the Army and a graduate of the program. And also, we have his daughter, Ashley Atkinson, who is with the National Guard and volunteers with the organization. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, Chris, I would first start with you. And what was the idea? I mean, how did this thing get started? And what was the idea behind utilizing dogs and particularly pets to be at least a complement to whatever kind of therapy, whatever kind of help that, some of these soldiers are getting?
Right. Actually, it kind of came to me when I was in Afghanistan, deployed there in Afghanistan. I was walking through one of the field hospitals, and they had a little child there that was blown up. And she was severely damaged, burnt-wise. And I had one of my dogs walking through, and she just – when she saw the dog, she just came to life. So long story short, that was really what got me thinking about the dogs and as far as helping our veterans out with it. So we came back, and we started it up because, like you said, you know, in Afghanistan, Iraq – some of the longest wars that we've been in, we got all these soldiers coming back. And like I say, the majority of the disabilities that we work with is actually PTSD. You know, nightmares, PTSD, along with that, you know, comes anxiety and depression. So that's what really got me focused in because I've always been a dog person. So, you know, getting dogs from rescues, pairing them up with our veterans, so you're kind of saving two things at one time. So that's what really got me into it, or starting us up.
Now, I understand that the Veterans Affairs, that they will cover vets with disabilities, but they've declined, at least, and you maybe correct me, they've declined to cover utilizing dogs with PTSD. Is that right?
That's correct. The only thing that the VA will cover for as far as a service dog is if, as they say, as description-wise, is if it's an extension of your body. So, for example, like if you're an amputee or if you're paralyzed, they will sponsor or pay for a service dog. But as far as anything else, PTSD, nightmares, flashbacks, seizures, you name it, it's all on us.
Why is it that you think?
That is a good question. I've researched and I've looked and I've talked to a plenty of people in the VA. But as of right now, there's just – I don't know if it's not enough money or a program, but we can't do anything with it for right now.
So my understanding, by the way, is that these dogs help for a variety of things. I mean, ranging from social isolation and job absenteeism and so on. What kind of impact do you think you see when you match up a service person with a dog, and what kinds of changes, what kinds of pitfalls do you think that they are able to avoid or at least overcome?
The easiest way I can sum it up in one thing is they save lives. You know, like the percentage rate is, you know, like I say, 22 per day. Well, with these dogs, you know, there's no medicine like these dogs out there. And these dogs actually save veterans' lives. So, I mean, that's the main thing that we look at. And that's what the main thing we come out with.
So what do you think they didn't do for them?
There's a variety of things, because basically what we do is we sit down, once we get a veteran into our program, we sit down and we evaluate the veteran. And because every veteran has their own special needs, you know, if it's PTSD, traumatic brain injury, or seizures or nightmares. So once we evaluate the individual, we can actually pair them up with the dog. So there's a variety of things. For example, for like me, I'm a disabled veteran, been diagnosed with PTSD. Along with that comes anxiety, depression, TBI, traumatic brain injury, which comes with a lot of memory loss. So there's these dogs can help us comfort us. They can actually bring us back into the world. A lot of these veterans haven't been out of their homes in years. So with our program, it actually we get them involved. We get them active in the program, so they're not sitting around dwelling on, you know, the past or think about maybe committing suicide or anything like that. So it keeps them occupied, and these dogs actually bring them back into the world. And you can't get much more love than a dog. You know, no matter what you do, you got unconditional love from these animals. So that's, you know, that's an awesome pair up.
So you mentioned a moment ago that you had PTSD. Did you utilize a dog, or was that something, or were you able to? I don't know whether you ever actually overcome anything like that, but
I had a service dog, but she's retired right now. So I've been kind of waiting for my pair to come up with me. But actually, me doing this program with the veterans, these guys and girls are my therapy, because we can all relate to each other. So we're kind of, you know, lean on each other for our support and outside of the dog program as well. So, but yeah, that's where we're at.
So, and where did you serve, by the way?
I did Desert Shield, Desert Storm, Afghanistan. Like Dan Ray, all the above.
All of the trifecta, they
so,
say, right?
Been around, yes, definitely. I did 11 years altogether.
Ah, okay. So Dan Atkinson, first describe for me what the conditions were like in those war situations. Because, you know, they were in some ways they were traumatic. They were traumatically different than, say, for instance, the Second World War. And veterans actually had space between the time they left the battlefield and actually the time they got home. What was that like for people, most people, who have no experience whatsoever? What experience was your like, if you can describe that?
I really can't explain
yeah.
It's combat in a foreign country these days is so, it's difficult to explain unless you've actually been there. I mean, the lay person, you know, that lives here in the United States, goes to their 9-to-5 jobs, you know, they really can't understand the pressures that you're under, because from the time you leave your family to the time you land in country, from that moment you step off that plane, your life is in jeopardy 24/7, 7 days a week. You're constantly looking over your shoulder. You're hyper vigilant. Anything and everything can kill you overseas when you're in a combat zone. You don't trust anything. Back in the day, you know, Vietnam, World War I, World War II. You knew what your enemy, you knew who your enemy was. Your enemy was in a uniform, you know, on the other side, you know, in an army. The wars that we're fighting now are individuals that will have their children kill you. That will, you know, they all dress exactly alike. They're civilian. It's like going to the mall. You know, you go to the mall and anybody in there at any time could try to kill you. And that's what it's like in country. It's you're paranoid constantly. Your head's always on a swivel. You don't trust anybody except for the people that are in your unit. And it is very hard when you come home to turn that off. I mean, we are trained to be that way, and it's very difficult, you know, once you get home with your family, to turn that vigilance off and that paranoia off. And it's just very difficult to understand unless you've actually been there.
As I mentioned, I think before the program, I've been reading a bit about Afghanistan, and one of the situations, there was a unit of something like 19 guys who arrived in Afghanistan. After 3 weeks, there were only six left.
Yes, sir.
Does those kinds of deaths of your fellow officers, fellow soldiers, does that also have this, emphasize this impact?
Absolutely. You train with individuals in a unit. You become closer than some of your own family members. You rely on each other every day, all day long, 24/7, and they are your family. Closer, I believe, a lot of the guys that I serve with are closer to me than blood relatives. And to lose one is, it's absolutely devastating, because some people have regret. They feel that it was their fault, that they could have changed something. If they'd have done this, that individual would still be here today. You know, so there's a lot of guilt that goes along with being a service member that loses someone. And that's part of PTSD, too, guilt, survivor guilt. And it's hard to get through. There's a lot of therapy, but therapy doesn't do everything. Therapy helps the individual that's going through the therapy. It doesn't cure them. You'll never be cured. It's a constant for the rest of your life. Now, they do get medications, which help with some things, but they'll never be cured. Since I've had Gus, mm-hmm. From the day I got home, maybe a year later, I started realizing that I had PTSD. I had anger issues. I would just go off at the drop of a hat with anger, and I had no idea why. My family, I started drinking, and I drank constantly. I would not leave my house. I can't tell you how long ago I stopped going to a grocery store or anywhere that there was a crowd. I became a recluse in my own home. Even with my own family, I would push my family away. I built a wall around myself because I didn't want nobody to get in. And when you build a wall, it's hard for people to get in to you. And it's just as hard for you to get out. And so, you know, with a service dog, going to the training sessions and everything got me out of the house. I was responsible. This is my new battle buddy. This is my new battle buddy right here. And I'm responsible for his health and welfare. And you realize that you have to go every week to class. You have to do this. You have to get them out to exercise. You know, they have to go outside to do this. And it gets you into a routine that gets you out of the house and makes you quit thinking about all the stuff that's in your head and in your heart. And you start taking care of something that takes care of you. And like I said, it's a battle buddy. I can't go nowhere without them. I don't go anywhere without them. But now I'm able to go to a store. I'm able to go to a grocery store and get something. Not on peak hours or nothing like that, but I'm still able to get out of the house. I don't drink as much. I mean, it was bad. Bad enough that I was drinking 30 beers a day, you know, just to sleep and just to get by, because I just there was nothing helping me. Therapy wasn't helping me. Medications from the VA wasn't helping me. But he helps me because I have to take care of him.
What are the kinds of things, if there are kinds of things, that set off that kind of panic or that kind of comeback in terms of PTSD? I mean, is there?
For me, there's every soldier or everybody with PTSD has triggers. Yeah. And they're called triggers. Like me, the smell of diesel fuel. I cannot stand it. I do not like doorways scare the crap out of me because you don't know what's on the other side. And with having Gus, he always goes to the door first, and he will alert me if anybody's on the other side of the door, which makes me feel better going through the door. And diesel fuel, doorways, explosives, loud noises, sudden loud noises make my heart just jump. I mean, but there's a lot of triggers, and a lot of people are different.
Let me ask you, by the way, when you came back, you obviously served a number of times. Did you have this feeling that you needed to go back?
Yes.
I mean, was that because of the people you left behind, or was it because of the kind of environment, mental environment that you were in, that's like you were drawn back to that?
I no longer fit in society here when I got home. I was comfortable overseas because that's just the way it was. I was comfortable there, and I was responsible for myself, and I knew my mission, I knew my job, and I did my job well. But when you come home and you no longer have that, you're kind of lost. You don't know what to do with yourself. I mean, I was a Cav Scout. I was in the United States Cavalry, and what kind of job is that for me over here? You know, home in the civilian world, there is none, and it was very difficult. And going back overseas, I knew what I was doing.
Ashley, I want to turn to you. So what was it like when he came back? I mean, what was that like for you as a family member?
He was always very drawn away from us. He was always very quiet, and then he would drink, and it was just – he couldn't be there for us at all. And it's really hard because when he's gone, we learn to live without him. And then when he comes back home, it's very hard to get him back into our routine. And it almost gets to the point where it feels like he's not really part of our family anymore. He's just, I guess you would say, like an appendage. And because he wasn't who he was when he left. And then he would come home and he wasn't our dad anymore. He was just this guy that we didn't know who you were. Like, he couldn't go to the grocery store with us. He couldn't do anything. And he just would stay at home. And it's almost like he never came home sometimes. It's like he was still there. And it would get really, really difficult when, because you're so excited to see them and you're so excited for them to be back in your home. And they're just not the same person. They're not, it doesn't work anymore. And it takes a really long time. And then he would be very excited to leave again. And as a family member, you're sitting there and you're like, I don't want you to leave, especially as a child. You know, I was growing up through all of his deployments, and when he would leave again, he would be so excited. He would be like, oh, well, I have to do this. This is my job. And, you know, you would sit there and you would be like, well, this is your job. This is your family. You built this. This is who we are. And then he would leave. And then he would come back, and it was always, you never knew what dad you were going to get. You didn't know if you were going to get the dad that you that left or came back, or it was just, and some days were good days, and he would go out and we'd go play ball or we'd go to a ball game or something. And then the very next day we couldn't go to the park. We couldn't leave the house. We couldn't do anything. And he would just engorge himself into work sometimes, like a lot. And then it's just like, you're still gone because we're still not seeing you. And he would be, his drinking got really, really hard, and he would not come home for days. He would be out with his friends and his battle buddies, and he had more of a connection. And seeing him with them, it was like, that's the dad that I want. He's your best friend when you're growing up, and then he comes back home and he's everybody else's best friend. And it was a very hard struggle.
So what was it like in terms of the family dynamic? I mean, your mother, for example, I mean, how did that impact that family unit? What was it?
Well, it was really, we have a very different case because my parents were divorced.
Okay.
And I actually kind of stayed with foster parents while my dad was deployed. And then when he came back home, it was really hard because I was living with foster parents and they wanted me to stay with them while I was going through school because everybody knew what was going on with him.
Yeah.
They knew that he was starting to have issues and they didn't want me to progress back into the family that we had built. So it was really, it's a very different dynamic than a lot of other families at this, that instance. But it was a struggle. And then he went through another divorce. So it was just a complete broken family all the time. We had no consistency. We couldn't build anything. We couldn't keep things going.
I mean, how does that affect you growing up? I mean, I grew up in a family where two parents were there like there forever and they were always there. What does that do to somebody as you grow up? How do you cope with that kind of uncertainty, I guess?
You learn responsibility very early. Mm-hmm. I mean, you take care of yourself a lot. You're in constant missing of your dad. I mean, it's really hard because you don't ever really know what's going on with him. And there was a lot of times after he came back home where it was more or less I was kind of his keeper, and I was trying to take care of him and make sure that he was okay. I was driving him around because he couldn't drive anywhere. When he would go out in public, I was just basically a service dog, and I wasn't very good at it.
Right.
So it was a struggle.
So when he got the dog, what kind of change do you think you saw? Was it immediate or was it gradual?
It was absolutely instantaneously. When he got Gus as a puppy, and I went over to visit him, and it was just, you could just see the connection with him, and he was, like, just jumping right into all the literature and trying to learn all this stuff about how to do the service dog and how to train him and everything. And it was so nice to see him having a, I would say, hobby, but engorging himself into something. And he started going out, and he takes Gus to the mall and walks around with him, and it's just nice to see him get out of the house and his drinking cut back, and it's been absolutely amazing. It's to see the transformation within such a short period of time where he's lived a certain way for 15, 20 years, and then all of a sudden this dog comes into his life, and it's just, it's absolutely amazing.
Chris, I want to turn to you because you're reacting to all of this. What are your feelings?
I'm teared up right now. You know, it's because I know what he's going through, and to see it from a family aspect of it, you know, because we don't see it from their side. So we don't realize because we're dealing with our own issues. And like he was saying before, like they were saying before, is that as far as us coming home, because when we're deployed overseas, we have like our own little, as they described over there, like our own little tribe, our own little group, our own little family. So we know we can always depend on someone or depend on each other. We know we have each other's back over there. We know that everybody that's deployed cares about each other. And like Dan was saying, when we come home, there's nobody. Yeah, we have family, and they're there, you know, supporting us and everything. But, you know, we're kind of dealing with our readjustment from over there to back here. Over here, you know, we come back, there's nothing. It's sad to say, but there's like nothing here for us. We have no support as far as like the camaraderie that we had over there. We have no guidance. We have to readjust to, like Dan was saying, you know, our heads on a swivel over there. We come back. My wife's, it's so funny, is I'll be driving down the road. She goes, "Keep your eyes on the road." Well, my head's on the swivel. I'm waiting for someone to pop out from behind the building. I'm looking at the pothole in the road for an IED or. So that's the mentality that we have as far as when we come back. So, but it's so hard to us to readjust to the life back over here. And plus, like you said, we have family, but we're alone. I don't know if I'm saying that right. But yeah, it's tough to readjust. It's tough to readjust for, like Ashley was saying, for both sides, for us and our family members. Because when we come back, like you said, we're changed. We're totally different. And they don't understand that because, like Dan was saying, you really have to be there to understand. So it's tough. It really is. Really is.
What was your, as much as you would tell me, what was your wife's, how did your wife handle you coming back? I mean, was that a tough one?
She still is. She's still handling it. Yeah. It's sad to say, but because, you know, like I said, you know, we have a couple nights ago, I have nightmares real bad. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she's seen me doing a low crawl across the bottom of the bed, and she's scared to wake me up. She's wondering what's going on. You know, am I going to react to her waking me up and vice versa with my kids? You know, I got little ones. Once in a while, they'll come up into the bed. And if I'm tossing, turning, or if I start reenacting a nightmare or something, who knows what I'd do? So there's that thought that's always in my head. So I have to be aware of my surroundings as far as here, my family, and my family is still adjusting to, heck, I'm still adjusting coming back. So like I said, there's really no easy cure for this. But these dogs, that's the closest thing I found to a cure for any of this because they calm us down, they become, I guess, part of our tribe. You know, we know that dog's going to be there no matter what. And, yes, our family members are, too. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
Because this
right.
is hard for our family as well. So, but, yeah, it's tough. It's tough.
So do dogs – I'll turn to you, Dan. So one of the observations, I guess, was made in addition to whatever emotional connection that you have is a dog is, as it's been described, as sort of a bridge between you – and the outside world. Do you think that's, you know, in terms of interacting with it, that the dog is like as buffer that.
Absolutely.
Do you think it's true?
Absolutely. And just you know, in my case with Gus, if I go to a grocery store, Gus is always, he always walks on my left-hand side, which keeps people kind of away from me. So nobody walks up on me quickly. Most people just stop and look at the dog. They don't approach me. You know, if they do approach me, they approach very slowly and say, "May I pet your dog?" or something like that, which is great. When I'm standing in line, Gus will stand so he's looking behind me so nobody's coming up can come up with behind me without me knowing it. You know, and that, and those are small things. If I start getting overwhelmed, Gus will alert on me and let me know, hey, it's time for you to leave, and I will stop what I'm doing. If I'm shopping or what, I will stop what I'm doing, and he will take me to the nearest exit. He will get me to a safe spot and get me out of there until I calm down. Once I calm down, we can resume what we were doing. He wakes me up from nightmares, like Chris has. He sleeps on my bed with me, facing the doorway, at my feet. And if I start moving at night, he will come up and start licking me and trying to lift my hands up and trying to wake me up. He used to paw my face, but I got him out of that because I was going everywhere with scratches right on my face. But, you know, training. But he's better than any medication the VA could have ever gave me. If they'd have just gave me a service dog, a lot of my problems would have been done and over with years ago.
So when you first met the dog, was it an instantaneous attachment that you found, or did it grow over time? And was that also involved with some kind of training as well?
Of course it was a puppy. Of course it was a puppy, and right, everybody loves puppies. If you don't like puppies, you're heartless. But it took a while for us to be really close because I didn't understand his demeanor. And 'cause dogs are like anything else. You know, everybody has their own personalities. You know, it took me a while to get used to Gus's personality. It took him a while to get used to me, you know, and it built over time, like any relationship does. It builds over time. And the longer he's been with me, the stronger our relationship is. And it's amazing. It's amazing the bond that him and I have with each other. I mean, I know his schedule. He knows mine. I mean, we know each other's schedule. He knows what time I'm supposed to take my medication. I know what time he's supposed to eat. You know, we know everything there is to know about each other. And he doesn't speak, but he knows. He absolutely knows. He triggers on anything that's wrong with me as I do with him.
So Ashley, what is it like to have this dog around?
I mean,
how do you relate to
It's like having a little brother.
Is that right?
Yeah. He's extremely a part of our family. Every event that we go to, everything that we do as a family, and Gus is part of the family. He's an annoying little brother sometimes, and
right,
it's really great. He's definitely helped our whole family grow together. I mean, there's things that we haven't been able to do for years, and now that Gus is a part of our family, we can do things together now. I mean, it's incredible.
So we mentioned earlier that you volunteer with the organization. What do you do there? But B, how has that affected the way you experience this kind of trauma?
So when they do like benefits and stuff, I help out and help them put things together. The first time that I went to one of my dad's training things, at first I was like, oh, well, we're just going to go learn how the dog sits, and like this is going to be different. And it wasn't that. It was more of a therapy thing. They were all sitting around in a circle talking, and there was more talking than there was dog training going on. It was just a bunch of guys talking to each other and relating, and we walked around at Lowe's, and it was a bunch of guys looking at lumber and right, talking to each other. And it was, you really could see the camaraderie between the veterans with each other and their dogs, and the dogs interact with each other, and it's a lot of fun for them. And it really opened my eyes because, you know, when they come home, they're so dialed up, and to see them all together, they have a chance to dial down a little bit. And it was incredible to see all of them getting along, because you know that everybody in that room has issues with certain things, and to see them be able to talk to each other and laugh and relate with each other and talk about their dogs and watch their dogs play. And it was really awesome.
By the way, did you get a sense that your dad wasn't the only one, that it made you more aware of the fact that there are lots of guys like this?
Absolutely. Especially once you see them like training with their dogs, you see how they react with each other. And like when we went to Lowe's, for example, you could see there was three of them, and you could just see them. They're just dialed up throughout Lowe's, but with these dogs, they were paying attention to their dogs, and it was they really had a good dynamic.
Chris, I want to ask you, so there's also this idea about, I guess the phrase was dropping the leash. That is the idea that, that the vets will be with these dogs for a while, but not necessarily forever. What do you think about that? And are you going to be with your dog forever? Or?
Well,
No,
that's fine. I mean, once we pair you up with a dog, you're with that dog to the end.
Okay.
And that's one reason why I like having the veterans, us training the veterans to train their own dog, because they form a tighter bond. And we got some veterans that you try to take their dog away. Good luck. Thanks for playing.
Right.
I mean, we've had a couple people that's had to go into the hospital for emergency purposes. And they're like, well, we can't take your dog. You can't take your dog. And they're like, well, you just might as well call the sheriff's department because I'm not going without my dog. So, I mean, it's like I say, like Dan was saying, okay. You know, sometimes these dogs, you know, these dogs are like our family members. You know, you protect them to the end and vice versa. These dogs are going to be with you to the end. So, yeah, you know, once we pair you up or, you know, you get your service dog, it's to the end.
Dan, you think it'll be with your dog to the end?
Oh, I will.
Yeah.
And I think about it every day. Average lifespan of a lab is 14 years.
Yeah.
It's not very long.
Right.
And it breaks my heart just thinking about it. You know, just I don't want him to ever go. I mean, I really don't. It's going to be like losing a child.
Yeah. And
thank God I've never had to experience that, but it's going to be like losing a child.
It's sort of a day-by-day kind of thing. You know that's out there, but you don't think about it.
I live my day like it's his last. Because, yeah. I mean, it's just, we have a great time together. I mean, he runs faster than me, thank God. You know, I don't pay ball, but he does. So, you know, it's right. just we do things together, and it's fun for me. I'm home alone. My wife works. My kids work. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm home alone during the day, and it just gives me some fun stuff to do, and I enjoy it. And I'm not sitting around drinking and feeling sorry for myself and thinking the world's terrible place to live. And it's wonderful therapy. Wonderful therapy.
So now do you want to stay home or do you have some kind of work you do?
No,
or
sir, I do not work.
Not right at the moment. Do you think you might down the road?
I will never
maybe?
Work again.
Never work again.
No,
okay. Well, so, what about you?
Except for I'm going to put him to work though.
Oh, well, yeah.
I do volunteer. He helps
me out a lot. US Kennel. Yeah, don't worry. You volunteer and he'll take a lot more. But what about you? Do you work? Are you?
This is.
Or is this your full
gig? This
time,
is my
gig?
Full gig. I don't get paid for it. It's, you know, all volunteer.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like I said, we're a 501c3 nonprofit. But this, like I said, this is really therapy for me. Like Ashley was saying, you know, all of us get together. You know, we can all relate to each other. We feel comfortable around each other because we've all been there. We've all done it. And a lot of us are going through the same thing, so we can really relate to everything. So me going to work and doing this, totally my therapy. So,
what's the funding source for this?
Basically, for its funding, it's donations, fundraisers. We just had an awesome fundraiser on the 29th. We raised $2,200 at Market Street Inn. We're going to be having some more fundraisers coming up soon. We have Tito's, sounds bad, Tito's Vodka.
Okay.
But they sponsor us.
Yeah.
They do what's called a Yappy Hour. And at Market Street Inn for Happy Hour, and you can bring your pets too for the summer. It's every Wednesday, starting the second through the last week of, or to the week after Labor Day, every Wednesday. So whatever Market Street makes as far as 10% for his donation stuff, they're going to match that. Plus every drink that they sell of their products, all of that goes towards us. So, but we're always looking for sponsors. We're always looking for donations. So definitely, you know, it's a hard thing to do, you know, trying to raise money, but,
sure.
But right now, you know, like you guys having us on, and we appreciate that, by the way. But we're getting there and we're growing really, really, really fast, which is a good thing.
So now obviously you're dealing with Salisbury and this area here. I mean, are there other, I assume there are other organizations or your organization reaches out to beyond this area? What's
our area we cover is on the Eastern Shore, mm-hmm. Virginia, Maryland, and Delaware.
Okay.
So we cover like all three states on the shore. And if you live across the bridge, you know, we'll take you as well.
Sure, sure.
So with that, we cover a large area. And as far as other organizations, you know, it's like Operation We Care, we help them, and they help us. As a matter of fact, they donated a nice first canine first aid kit and some training obstacles as well. So and then we try to go and help them out. So, you know, scratch your back, scratch our back. With the VFW's American Legions, you know, they donate some money. And then likewise, if they have some events, we'll go out and set up a table. And also, it's good networking because, yeah. Like I say, our main thing is we're trying to reach out to these disabled veterans to help them out and get them a service dog.
Well, we've been speaking with Chris Hardy. He's the executive director of an organization that takes care of veterans and these matches them up with dogs. It's called U.S. Kennels Incorporated. Also on our show, we had Dan Atkinson. He was in the Army for about 25 years, toured both Afghanistan, Iraq, amongst others, as well as the Gulf War. And also his daughter, Ashley Atkinson, who's in the National Guard. And we do appreciate you all taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you for having us.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.